The next case on calendar today is Torres versus Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, case number 60904. Are you ready to proceed?
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Alan Kapp, and along with Albert Massey, we represent the Torres appellants in this appeal. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue on this appeal is whether or not compound interest should be applied to Nevada judgments. And it's the appellant's position that NRS 17.130 provides for interest on interest every 6 months by its express words. And this is also supported by the legislative history of this statute. I would like to deal first with the court's order, and I'll deal with the meaning of the terms per annum and adjust it accordingly, and then I'll move to the historical question. NRS 17.130, as far as post-judgment interest is concerned, states that it is to be at a rate equal to the prime rate at the largest bank in Nevada. And the prime rate is used as a basis for all bank loans, and all bank loans involve compound interest. So a post-judgment interest rate cannot be equal to the prime rate unless it provides for some form of compounding. Moving to the term per annum. Per annum is synonymous with simple interest. Even the respondent's reply brief refers to this term per annum as being consistent with simple interest. This term has been around in Nevada in predecessor statutes for a long time. One of the cases cited on appeal is Hastings versus Johnson. That's a Nevada one case going back to 1866. In that case, they referred to an interest statute, Section 5, page 100, statutes of 1861. So this term per annum has been around for about 150 years. And if the purpose of this statute was to maintain status quo with simple interest, why eliminate this term? Per annum could have been inserted into the statute at various places, but it could have read at a rate equal to the per annum prime rate. It's important to note at this point that you can have a variable rate, and that variable rate can either be a per annum simple interest rate or it can be a compound rate.
Mr. Kapp, I have a question. If the legislature had intended it to be a compounded interest, could they not have said so?
Well, we have the Uinoro versus Mercer case, and the Nevada Supreme Court in that case allowed post-judgment interest on pre-judgment interest. And they did that with any time you have interest on interest, that's compounding. And they did that without actually using the word compounding. So there are no magic words and phrases, and there are different ways of saying things.
And follow-up question is, how many jurisdictions that have similar statutes to ours actually allow for there to be compounded interest of this nature that you're advocating?
Well, I think there are probably about three jurisdictions in the United States that provide the use of their compound interest in their statutes, so about three. And moving on to the term adjusted accordingly, this is, we have the two words joined together, and adjusted means to make corresponding with, and accordingly means to bring in agreement or to bring in harmony with. An accord is an agreement. And we have no other state that I'm aware of in the United States in the post-judgment statute that uses this particular phrase. So if the rate was supposed to just be a variable rate, that phrase should have read adjusted periodically. And the only way to adjust accordingly, looking at the plain meaning of these two words, is and to bring the interest rate into harmony with the prime rate every 6 months is to add interest to principal. Now, if we look at the legislative history does mention adding interest to principal. In the joint appendix at page 522, Assemblyman Callister is talking about, there's a discussion about the difficulty of computing interest. And he's talking about post-judgment interest because in Nevada, simple interest applies to pre-judgment interest, and there's no difficulty in making that calculation. And then Chairman Sater stated, interest was added to the principal amount of the judgment. And that's consistent with the term adjusted accordingly, in that the statement indicates that interest should be added to principal when talking about post-judgment interest. I'd like to talk for a minute about prime plus two, and I'll refer to that as the kicker. And in the legislative history, Mr. Bottoms, who was representing the Nevada Insurance Association, and this is in the record, joint appendix, page 511, he's talking about a fixed rate of interest of 12% under the 81 statute as being not particularly effective or fair to either side. And then he goes on to say, at some point this fixed rate is going to be unfair to one party or the other. So he uses this comparison. He talks about a normal borrower going into a bank and being able to borrow money at 2 to 3%. And the analogy there is the borrower would be the judgment creditor. And he talks about the other person who has the money, and that would be the judgment debtor. He could go out and invest the money at the same rate. So what we're trying to do here is to establish the fact that the judgment creditor and the judgment debtor, as far as interest is concerned, should be on the same basis. So what is fair for one side should be fair to the other side. So combining the language and legislative history, the most reasonable interpretation of NRS 17.130, the 87 revision, is that it unambiguously provides for compound post-judgment interest every 6 months. Now, if the court believes that this language is ambiguous, then we have to look at the legislative history. We use a three-part test. We look at the meaning of the words, which I already talked about, and we believe that the legislative intent is reflected not only by the language used, but also by the language that was not used by the legislature. And I've already talked about the causes which induced the legislature to adopt this change in the statute when I talked about the kicker. So I'm going to move to the spirit of the law and what is reasonable. And so the legislative history and the cases on post-judgment interest say that it has two purposes. One is to provide incentive to resolve judgments properly, and the other is to compensate the judgment creditor for the loss of money until paid. The legislative history is full of comments concerning what is fair for one side has to be fair for the other side, and there has to be a level playing field. Now, I believe that Respondent's Counsel defined this issue the best, and when I'm talking about this issue, I'm going to be talking about what I call the spread. And Goodyear's counsel in the court below, this is a joint appendix, page 290, said that we can't post a bond because we would lose the interest. And implicit in that statement is, hey, you know, we can make money by collecting the interest and posting the bond, and this is what I call the spread. So how much was the spread? Goodyear's counsel said it's going to cost us $300,000 a year to post this bond on a $34 million judgment. So if you go back to Mr. Bottoms' analysis that, you know, the judgment creditor or the judgment debtor can go out and invest the money and get the prime plus two, then if you go back to that analysis, that is exactly what's happening here on appeal. So how much is that? So if you can go out, if the judgment debtor can go out and invest the money and get the prime plus two, which when this judgment was entered in February of 2007 was 10.25% approximately, If you can get 10% on the money, simple interest, that's $3.4 million a year. You subtract the bond from that, and we still have $3,100,000 per year. And if you, the interest rate on this judgment fell, and it stayed at 5.2% in 2009. So even at that rate, you take half of that amount, so that's still about $1.5 million a year. So that's enough money. You've already paid for the bond. You have money left over to pay your attorneys to do the fee appeal, file motions, and it makes no sense to settle the case if the spread is in your favor. Now, the next thing I'll go to is overcoming the wrong history favoring simple interest. And under common law, the common law just hated compound interest or any form of interest. And the common law considered interest and compound interest to be usually and penal in nature. So this brings up the whole idea of unregulated Shylocks out on the street loaning poor people money and Merchant of Venice and a pound of flesh and all that kind of stuff. And originally in Nevada, we had a statute that said, hey, you can't have compound interest. And even if you had a contract or if you had a mortgage and it had compound interest in it, you couldn't get it if you went into court because statute prohibited it. Then what happened is we had statutes like NRS 99.050 that came along, and it limited the amount of interest that could be charged. And in 1913, it was 12%, and then it moved to 18%. And then in 1983, the statute said, well, we don't care how much interest, as long as the parties agree to it, and it could even be compound interest, we don't care. The next thing that happened was that, you know, we had Unaware versus Mercer, and that allowed post-judgment interest on pre-judgment interest, which is a form of compounding. We have our judgment removal statutes in Nevada that allow interest after 6 years on the combined principal and interest. That's a form of compounding. And the federal law now provides for compounding on post-judgment interest. I'd just like to make one more comment on the time value of money. And this court has commented on that previously, but we've all heard the saying the dollar isn't worth what it used to be. So what we have is when a loan is initiated and when a judgment is entered, we have old dollars. They're in old dollars. And then when it's paid back later, years later, it's paid back by new dollars. And the reason for that is that the new dollars have less buying power than the old dollars back at the time of the judgment. So the banking industry, what they did is they made an adjustment. They equated old dollars to new dollars, and that's how we got compound interest. And if it applies to bank loans, it should also apply to judgments. And all this reflects an attitude toward compound interest, a change of attitude, and these are the reasons and rationales for this court to overcome the long history favoring simple interest. Thank you.
Chief Justice Pickering, may it please the court, Dan Pulsenberg for the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. Let me start briefly with a textual approach, because I think Mr. Kapp is right, that's how we start. And I think the textual approach is expressed in Justice Sotomayor's two questions. You look at the wording of the statute. It doesn't say compound interest. The legislature could have said compound interest. It knew how to do it when it amended NRS 99.040 in 1987, there was a reference to the parties can agree to compound interest. And not only does the law have a long-standing aversion when it comes to compound interest, the common law didn't allow interest at all. Interest is a creature of statute. Now, we could discuss in your third question to us whether this court should use its common law powers to allow interest or compound interest, but really, the legislature has occupied the field at this point, and they have passed a statute where there's no indication whatsoever that it's compound interest. And your second question, Justice Sotomayor, is do other statutes with this wording, do courts interpret them as allowing for compound interest? No. The three examples we have that the counsel expressed were statutes that provided for compound interest, and even that is incredibly rare. But let me jump to what the legislature was doing before I go into the per annum and adjusted accordingly textual arguments. The legislature, you can see the changes in the statute. They went from, remember the in the late 70s and the early 80s, the interest rates were going up. Even to the point where 1981, the prime interest rate was 19%, and we had a statutory interest rate of 7. So in 79, they changed 7 to 8, and in 81, they changed 8 to 12, and there was an argument that it should be 20. So in 87, they did what they talked about doing in 1981, and they went to a floating interest rate, because that would be fair. Have the interest rate adjust itself to the changing market conditions. Assembly McAllister argued, why doesn't the legislature just meet every 2 years and change the interest rate? But most people agreed to tie it to something where it would do it automatically. And almost universal acceptance, except for Assemblyman McAllister and Porter, even the lobbyists all agreed eventually that it should be prime plus two. Because look what that does. It not only ties it to the prime rate, it adds, as Mr. Kapp today calls it, the kicker. It's 2% more. If the prime rate is 10%, there's an additional 20%. The prime rate during most of the time period we're talking about here was 3.25%. So judgment creditors get 5.25%. That's an increase of over 60% over what the prime rate is. Now, we've heard anecdotal stories about how defendants will appeal because they can earn more, and they cite to nothing in their briefs about this, and they cite to nothing here. And if we're talking about anecdotes, I can tell you I have many clients who cannot, and some of them are very sophisticated financial institutions, and they can't go out and earn prime plus two to cover this. This is a rate that the legislature expressly picked for two reasons: to compensate plaintiffs for not having the money, and to discourage defendants from appealing just to stall. Because honestly, we've all heard stories about the MGM fire and the Hilton fire and other cases back then. Well, yes, if you're paying a legal judgment rate of 8% and you're earning 19%, that incentive was there to do that. Now, I'm not saying I did that. That certainly was before my time. But the legislature took that into account. So it is a high interest rate. They didn't express for compounding. We have a history here of not allowing compounding unless it says so. Plaintiffs come in and say, and notice Assembly McAllister was one of the plaintiff's attorneys in this case representing the Bahena plaintiffs, and he dropped this appeal. But the plaintiffs do argue here that there are two things in the textual approach that make you think that it's compound interest. And one is that they say per annum. The statute used to say per annum, and it doesn't anymore. Well, it doesn't make sense that it would say it. It used to say 7% per annum, and then 8% per annum, and then 12% per annum, and now it says the prime rate. Now, for the first time at all in this case, they've suggested today an argument that it could say the per annum prime rate. But the prime rate is, the interest rate is necessarily an annual rate. You don't need that in there. There's nothing to be read in taking the words per annum out. And they cite to no cases that say that per annum means simple and the lack of per annum means compound. And really, if I wanted to be clever and find out other reasons that they would take out per annum, look, the legislature tries to update their statutes when they make amendments. Let's get rid of Latin. Look at it, 17.130 used to say, judgment shall be in dollars, cents, and mills, and now it says dollars and cents. It used to say, the judgment will bear interest, and now it says the judgment bears interest. It used to say, shall, and it said, must. The stylistic changes cannot sui generis express an intent to do something the statute doesn't say. Adjusted accordingly. In their opening brief, they think adjusted accordingly means, well, you must be compounding. And no, they've given up in their reply brief that adjusted means anything, and they just say accordingly. But where that all comes from is the proposal in 1987, it's an interesting legislative history. It was originally designed so that a trial judge would find out what the 52-week average T-bill rate was and apply that. And some legislators were saying, well, we don't want to have judges do all that work and have to try to figure out something. So what they did instead was they tied it to the prime rate. And they how are judges going to find out what the prime rate is? They tied it to the prime rate at the largest bank. And they said to the state agencies, publish a list. And it's in the record, and you've probably all seen it outside of this case, of what the prime rate is every January 1st and every July 1st. So there was less for judges to have to figure out. And honestly, I think that goes against their argument because we wouldn't try to make it more complicated by compounding when what we're really trying to do is just apply interest rates. But what they did... the original version of 87, after they amended it to be the prime rate plus 2, they just had it say the judgment shall bear interest at the prime rate plus 2. And George McNally came in and said, you know, it should say after the judgment that it's just not the prime rate at the January 1st or July 1st before the judgment, that every 6 months afterwards it's adjusted accordingly. Now that's a great idea because people know if the interest rate is going up and the defendant says, oh look, I can earn more money doing that by appealing, rather the same thing everybody seems to be talking about that defendants do that I've never really seen. Here it is, you're adjusting it both to compensate the plaintiff appropriately and to discourage people from taking meritless appeals. So he said, all right, he actually used the words in the legislative history, adjust accordingly. And in that very same hearing in the Assembly on May 21st, 1987, they added those words to the bill. Now, accordingly makes sense. They read something into accordingly, meaning, well, it must mean you're doing something according to something else, and then that has to be compounding. No, it was just the way to say accordingly is the prime rate without having to repeat the language, which I submit is misplaced in the statute anyway, without having to replace the language that says it's the prime rate plus two at the largest financial institution in Nevada, they simply use the word accordingly. So there's nothing in either of those two arguments that can let them have what they want. They talk about Unilever versus Mercer. Unilever versus Mercer, I lost that case. And just for the record, I lost it on many more issues than this one. But that case says, and appropriately, that when prejudgment interest is made part of the statute, and post-judgment interest runs on the judgment, necessarily post-judgment interest runs on pre-judgment interest. Now, there are cases in the country that say that that's also true when you renew a judgment out 5 years or 7 years, whatever the state does. Because when you renew the judgment, you're collapsing the judgment down into a new judgment. And all that judgment then becomes, all that interest rather, becomes part of the new judgment. But there is nothing in the every 6 month adjustment. And remember, the statute says the rate will be adjusted, not the judgment will be adjusted. There's nothing that says that any accrued interest gets added to the judgment and interest runs on interest. So Unilever doesn't help them. The historical approach, I think I've handled that in pointing out that the legislature was looking for was a way to serve these two purposes, and they are served by a higher interest rate, and there's no need to compound. Mr. Kapp says that I said it during the early hearings on whether we could have a stay from the original judgment that we can't post a bond. No, what I was saying was we can't post cash, and Rule 62D does provide for a supersedious bond. And the $300,000 we were talking about was a roughly 1% premium on the supersedious bond. So I don't think any of that has to do with what we are talking about here. And unless there are any questions,
Mr. Kapp?
I don't know how much time I have left.
You have 2 minutes.
Okay.
As far as 99040 is concerned, there's an attorney general's opinion on that. And that attorney general opinion just deals with prejudgment interest. It says basically if you want a contract, if you have a contract for a loan and it says compound prejudgment interest, you can have it. As far as, you know, specific language is concerned, there's more than one way to say something. And if you take a look at the first version of SB 45, that's in the record at page 508, you can see that that statute, that proposed statute, didn't even use the word per annum, but what it did was it tied it into the T-bill, and the T-bill is a simple interest instrument. They have a $1,000 T-bill, and the term is 1 year, and then you get 5% interest. You buy it for $950. At the end of the year, you get $1,000. But that first version of this statute didn't provide for an adjusted rate. It only applied for a single rate. As far as what interest rate should be on post-judgment interest, I mean, we had the 81 statute that said it should be 12% per annum. The 79 statute said 8% per annum. And then Assemblyman Castro and Assemblyman Porter, they said, hey, it's got to be up 20% so we can encourage the prompt payment of judgments. And that's the purpose behind the statute. As far as the kicker is concerned, we have to look at that in two ways. If you have the judgment creditor, he can go out and invest the money at prime plus two. You get the judgment creditor on the other side, he's got to go to the bank and he's got to borrow it, and he's got to borrow it at compound interest rates. So he's paying compound interest on any money he borrows because he doesn't have the judgment. And as far as adjusted accordingly is concerned, I think if I'm following the respondent's argument on that, he's saying that adjust and accordingly, are two words that mean the same thing. And if they mean the same thing, that would be redundant. And as I said, the appropriate term should have been adjusted periodically. So unless there are any questions, I'm finished.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This matter will stand submitted and will be at ease while the next group of lawyers...